among other things, lack of electricity was one such reason so that value addition could not happen in the rural areas in the first place. So we are hoping that with now a renewed focus on energy access for livelihood and income generating activities, we'd also see a more inclusive economies emerging over time. It's kind of a chicken and egg problem, where without the installations, you're not unlocking the support. Without support, you're not able to do more installations. And that's what we are trying to solve with this program called Powering Livelihoods.
That was right from the middle of this episode, where our guest shares the impact of energy access on livelihoods. So stay tuned for the full conversation. Hello and a big warm welcome to yet another episode on the Mission Shunya podcast. Well, this is not just another episode, it is episode number 75. I'll be the first to admit that it is just a number, but I am happy to hit this mark of 75 and clock close to 5 years in podcasting. In fact, Mission Shunya as a podcast is also close to 3 years now. The Weekend Passion Project has come a long way, and I'm sure it'll definitely continue for a long time. A big part of the journey is you, the listener. I can't thank you enough for that. Second, the guest who agreed to spare time on weekends to come and record for the show. And finally, the other big support community they have is friends and family, who are just happy to hit like, comment, and share the posts that we have on social media, that is Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. So thank you all for that. Needless to say, it goes a long way in the show's discoverability, and it definitely has a long-term impact. In case you haven't been an evangelist on that front, I would be happy if you can do that or write a review and rate the podcast on platforms that you listen to this on. Now let's get on to this week's show. If you are a regular listener, you know that I enjoy picking the brain of my friends and industry colleagues who are working in climate action from time to time on this platform. Well, it's a bit of coincidence that today's guest who is joining me for episode number 75 is also someone I have known for a long time in the industry, maybe for about 8 years or so. His passion and interest in a domain which we are going to discuss has only grown bigger over the years. So with that short note, who is our guest and what is he currently doing?
Hi. I'm Abhishek Jain. I'm a public policy professional. I work with a policy think tank called the Council on Energy, Environment and Water. Among other things, I also lead an initiative called Powering Livelihoods, which is a $3 million initiative to mainstream decentralized renewable energy solutions among the rural economy.
Abhishek, we have known each other for quite some time now, and it's been a long journey. And when I talk about this journey of yours, especially in the last 5 to 8 years, you have predominantly worked on energy access at CEW. So how did you get interested in this aspect, and how has the journey been so far for you?
I think I probably have to go back almost exactly a decade ago. It was somewhere in 2011, while I was working in the private sector here in India in an engineering role. I was reading a lot about both climate change and sustainability, as well as the social inequities around us. And I think among that, during that research, one of the things that really stuck to me, that one statistic which really stuck with me, was that 1 in 4 Indians did not have access to electricity back then. And I think while there are similar inequities for there, or some of them continues to be there, let's say with regards to access to clean water, sanitation, and so on, but somehow this one particular statistic, I was not able to be okay with it, so to say, that how can in 2010 and 2011, there are still 1 in 4 Indians who do not have access to electricity, something that you and I have taken for granted in our entire life, right? I mean, right from the earliest memories of my childhood, I know that electricity used to be there where I grew up, which was one of the cities in Punjab. So yeah, so that somehow became the starting point for I exploring this as a passion over time. Then I went on to do studies in sustainability. And even while I was applying for my master's, etc., when you write your statement of purposes, I categorically called out that this is something I want to pursue my research and further work in energy access as a field. And I'm glad that I've maintained that commitment to myself over the years, and also been fortunate that we have seen some good progress, at least in India, in the last one decade with regards to energy access.
That is correct. I mean, especially in the last decade, and I think it was just a perfect timing for you to be focused on this, and then also see good traction on ground. And you have directly had good experience on ground when I talk about that, looking at improved energy access in the field. So what's your experience been like after you finished your master's and back in India? I think that was the time, the 3-4 years was a really exponential growth in energy access.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been tracking and working in this space for now, as I said, since 2011-12. And then I came back to India in early 2014. I got fortunate enough to sort of then work in the space full time at CEW. So it's almost 8 years with CEW as well. And the very first thing that I did while coming to CEW was conducting this fairly large scale multidimensional survey on energy access, just to understand how big is the problem, but also where exactly is the problem. Is the problem in the eastern part of the country, in the western part of the country, in the suburbs, in the villages, which districts, and also not just geographically, where is the problem, but what kind of pain points are there when we are talking about energy access? It is not a binary whether you have electricity connection or not. Even after having an electricity connection, if you're not getting the supply for more than 4 hours a day, and that too at odd hours when you really do not need it as much, you're effectively still not having energy access. So that large-scale survey that we did with about close to 9,000 households, focusing on almost 75% of the energy access deprived population in the country, really revealed a lot of insights, not just for us as researchers, but also for policymakers to prioritize their action. So if District A in Madhya Pradesh is facing frequent power cuts vis-a-vis District D in Odisha, which is facing pretty significant challenges with regards to maintenance once the power is down. So different issues, and which mean that you need very different decentralized approaches to address these. In some cases, it is the affordability of connection, which is becoming the bottleneck. In other cases, it is not able to pay the recurring monthly expenditures, which is becoming the bottleneck for the households. So how do you look at energy access from a multidimensional lens was the first thing that we brought into India's policymaking. And simultaneously, by we focused on this aspect here in India, globally, we saw a similar approach evolving with the effort of World Bank, SMAP, and others on furthering multidimensional, multi-tier energy access frameworks. And that first report that we did back in 2015, which is called Access Report, really plugged some of the key knowledge gap in the area. It was released by the then Power Minister, Piyush Goyal, and the government started taking cognizance of, okay, what the gap is and what we need to do. And then engagements with the government followed on from that research over the next 2 years is what resulted in Sobhagya. So a lot of behind the scene efforts with the Ministry of Power in doing very bespoke analysis, district after district, state after state, that what need to happen in order to plug the energy access gap. So while Sobhagya did a phenomenal job in plugging that final gap in energy access, so to say, from a connections perspective, they made sure that all households are getting connected to either the grid or wherever grid is too far away through the solar home systems or other decentralized solutions. But at the same time, they also brought a thrust to improving the service delivery.
Correct.
So over years, we have actually seen that hours of supply have gone up across the country, especially in the rural areas. We have seen the quality of supply in terms of voltage interruptions and voltage spikes coming down. And we saw this firsthand when we did the second round of access survey back in 2018, after the Sobhagya scheme's implementation. So as such, we were able to almost do an impact assessment of Sobhagya scheme because we did one survey before Sobhagya in 2015, and then we did another one after Sobhagya in 2018. And we could see that apart from connection, there has been improvements on each of these metrics, be it hours of supply, be it the voltage quality, be it the maintenance of the electricity once there is a disruption, and so on. all of them have improved, and the customer overall satisfaction has gone up with regards to their NOC access. So yeah, so certainly a lot happened, I think, in the years followed from that access report. We saw equal traction even on the clean cooking energy side. You would be, and a lot of our audience would be familiar with the Pradhan Mantri Ujjwala Yojana.
Correct.
Which again tried to plug the gap on the clean cooking energy access in the country by enabling free or low-cost LPG gas connections, again, to the low-income households.
Correct.
So, yeah, so again, there we saw a lot of traction. I mean, both these schemes really have pulled a lot of people out of the abject energy poverty, as I would say. But yeah, the work is still not done. I think while this has been a huge impetus to the energy access and growth in the country, we do need to plug still more gaps with regards to, for example, sustained use of those LPG cook stoves so that people do not go back to or fall back to traditional biomass and expose themselves to indoor air pollution and so on.
Abhishek, I must say that the work that you did between 2015 to 2018, especially the access survey, it was really crucial, especially in identifying, as you say, the gaps in the existing system. Because until then, energy was mostly considered as whether you have or not, as you say, the binary aspect of it. And that was also a period when the remotest part was connected by microgrids and quality of power was total unknown. So I think that perfectly blend between what you did and what the Saubhagya scheme brought in. So that was a perfect time and the work that you did was really apt. Which leads me to the next part of your journey. It's been around looking at how energy access can enable better livelihoods for people. So how did that transition happen and how did you get started with that work? I'm sure like a lot of work that you did in the access survey kind of would have definitely helped you get there, right?
Right. So yeah, as you rightly said, I think what Saubhagya scheme did, it tried to plug the gap with regards to access, at least with regards to connections to grid electricity and wherever grid not possible, as I said, the off-grid solutions. But we also know that the focus was Saubhagya scheme was primarily on households. We were trying to make sure that every household in the country gets energy access, and the quality of energy access, of course, also improves over time. But in the process, we did not focus a lot on what happens to the other end users of electricity.
Correct.
Be it for social services like education or healthcare, and more importantly, for the livelihood activities of the rural areas. Because in today's day and age, almost every other livelihood in the country depends on electricity access, depends on energy for whatever value addition that livelihood is trying to do. So given that the Saubhagya scheme or the government effort in the recent years did not explicitly focus on livelihoods or the economic opportunities that can be enabled through provision of electricity or energy, we believe that that is a crucial area to now start focusing on, now that we have to a great extent plug the gap on energy access for the households. That's how our focus on livelihood started at CEW, and started with much like everything at CEW, with a research project to understand what is the real gap when we talk about electricity access for livelihoods, for the micro enterprises in the country, for the farmers in the country, and the off-farm activities that are happening in the rural areas. So we again did a research, but this time we did not do a primary survey, but we relied on the government's existing surveys, including NSSO, to understand the gaps there. And we found that among close to about 34 lakh or 3.4 million rural micro enterprises that exist in the country, and this was back in 2015-16 when NSSO gathered that data.
Okay.
Almost 14% of them, which is about 4.3 lakh, or about 4,300,000 rural micro enterprises, said that lack of reliable electricity was the biggest bottleneck to their business. And imagine this is, 15% of the enterprises saying electricity access is a bottleneck to the business when it was an open-ended question where they could have picked any response or could have said anything among, let's say, not getting enough raw material.
Correct.
Not finding enough demand for the products, not finding market linkages or labor. So among all kinds of challenges that a business could face, in such an open-ended situation, they said that not having access to reliable electricity is among the top challenges of our business. Now that told us, and when we started plotting where these enterprises are in the country, we realized that these are not coming from the usual suspects like Bihar or Eastern UP or Jharkhand, which have traditionally been poor on energy access.
Okay.
But actually, these enterprises who were feeling the pinch of electricity or lack of reliable electricity were coming from areas like Haryana, Maharashtra, parts of MP, which have seen relatively better energy access in the past. And that then made us realize that it is actually just the tip of the iceberg when we look at this number of 14% enterprises or 4.3 lakh micro enterprises. Because these are enterprises which have already existed and are already relying on energy access or electricity access to some degree to start feeling the pinch of the lack of it or the lack of reliability of it. But many enterprises which could have surfaced or should be surfacing in these other parts like Bihar, Eastern UP, as I said, or Odisha of the world, have not even surfaced because traditionally energy access has been so poor. So only that now energy access is arriving here in more reliable ways, you would see an influx of many more enterprises emerging on back of it. And then you, if you now do a survey after almost 7 years of that NSS survey, I'm sure that the landscape of these enterprises would evolve. You would now see many more of these in the areas which are currently facing the energy access challenge. So that became really the first trigger for us to start focusing on energy access for livelihoods.
That's really interesting, especially the stat that you mentioned. Centers in Maharashtra, Haryana, you would never expect someone would complain about access to reliable electricity at that point in time. So that's really interesting. And as you said, maybe when you do the survey now, you could have a different set of geographies. Now, when we look at the micro enterprises that you mentioned, what are these micro enterprises typically about? What do they serve and what is the products and services that they deliver?
Yeah, I think that's a very pertinent question. Just to caricature, like, what are we talking about here, right? I mean, think of any kinds of goods and services that are getting sold in the rural setting. This can be from as simple grocery shops to Kirana stores that you would find in every nook and corner of a village, to things like barber shops, beauty parlors, then service, more service-oriented enterprises like your cycle repair shops, your two-wheeler repair shops. Then you have some in the dairy value chain where they are retailing dairy goods, be it milk or other, or sweet-making shops. Then you start looking at, and these are now geographically specific, you will go to the coastal areas, you will find fishery outlets and so on. And similarly, then you see some of the processing-related setups, where it could be an atta chakki, a mill, a rice mill, an oil expeller extracting oil from the oil seeds. So various kinds of off-farm or non-farm activities that traditionally we define in the livelihood parlance,
okay,
which is trying to add some kind of value addition to the local produce. And then you also see, like, I mean, apart from agriculture, we know that textile is the second largest employer in the country.
Correct.
So when you think of textile, what are the kind of micro enterprises we are talking about? We're talking about whether it's a woman spinning charkhas to spun the yarn, to households doing weaving of that spun yarn into fabric. So your looms, hand looms or paddle looms or power looms. Or we are talking about ultimately the fabric getting converted into clothing. So custom tailoring is such a big profession across the country, especially in the rural areas. You have I think if my memory doesn't fail me here, almost 600,000 custom tailoring centers across the country.
Wow.
So almost 6 lakh of them. So yeah, so these are the kind of rural micro enterprises which are out there. And each one of them would feel a pinch with regards to productivity or quality of output if you do not have reliable electricity.
And maybe if I can test your memory again, that adds up to a lot of jobs in terms of job contribution and also percentage of economy activity, right?
Exactly. And in fact, I mean, while we say that half of rural India is still reliant on agriculture as a source of income, you would also see that over the years that the income contribution of agriculture is coming down in agriculture.
True.
And it is the non-farm incomes which are increasing, or the increasing share is coming from the non-farm incomes. And that's why relying on, I mean, or focusing on these micro enterprises become particularly important, because there is only that much livelihood that you can generate from agriculture. There's a lot of hidden or partial unemployment because of the high dependency on agriculture. So So you do need more and more avenues to create more value addition of the agriculture produce and other forms of value addition that can happen in the rural area or in the peri-urban areas. So if you think of most of the value addition that right now happens in the country, the raw produce from the rural areas actually move to the urban centers.
Correct.
And among other things, lack of electricity was one such reason so that value addition could not happen in the rural areas in the first place. So we are hoping that with now a renewed focus on energy access for livelihood and income generating activities, we'd also see a more inclusive economies emerging over time.
No, at this juncture, when you had like all the important data and you had like data from the field and also all the research data from the government portals and government sources, you did launch this program in a different kind of a partnership. So how did that partnership and collaboration come about?
Right. So let me just take a minute to, as a prelude to that partnership, right?
Sure.
So what happened that when we started looking at this big gap, we also started looking at what could be the solutions, right? And while decentralized off-grid solutions have played a role in plugging some of the energy access gap for households, we realized that despite the innovations in the preceding decade, most of the innovations have focused on households themselves, be it solar lanterns, be it solar home systems, and some of the mini-grid microgrids. But you haven't seen a lot of innovation flourishing with regards to leveraging the same decentralized renewable technologies for the productive use, for the micro-enterprises and livelihoods. And whatever technologies that have surfaced or whatever innovations that had happened, they were struggling to scale themselves up. So we analyzed the entire value chain, right from innovation to prototyping, or IDR to prototyping, to initial field testing, to commercialization and scale up, like across this innovation value chain, what are the challenges that innovators, entrepreneurs are facing? We spoke to 100 different stakeholders, including investors, incubators, accelerators, rural technology experts, rural development experts, the innovators and entrepreneurs themselves, financiers, bankers, that what would it take to really mainstream these solutions, which are right now pretty much on the margins of the margins, I would say, so that they can start creating a dent in the rural economies, in the livelihoods and job story of the country.
Okay.
And it is that research which led to then realization that, okay, there are a few companies who are actually doing or coming up with these very interesting field-tested solutions. And when I say solutions, like think of things like solar-powered cold storages, solar-powered refrigerators, waste biomass-powered cold storages, solar looms, solar charkhas, solar-powered hydroponic stations which can grow fresh green fodder for you. So various kinds of innovations that were out there, already deployed with some of the customers, but the deployment scale remained very small. I mean, we are talking about tens or at best hundreds. Whereas here we are talking about millions of micro enterprises who are suffering with the energy access challenges. So we clearly saw that there is an opportunity here to expand and scale up this sector in a big way. But we also saw a big problem. The problem was that these companies, these social enterprises, so to say, who have come up with these solutions, they were struggling to scale themselves up because they needed support from financiers, from investors, as well as policymakers, in order to expand the installation base. And these financiers, investors were actually looking for more and more proof on the ground before they could unlock their support. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, where without the installations, you're not unlocking the support. Without support, you're not able to do more installations.
Fair.
And that's what we are trying to solve with this program called Powering Livelihoods. Now, this is a collaboration, as you said. It's a partnership between CEW, which is a policy think tank, and Willgrow, which is one of the oldest social enterprise incubator in the country. It took us almost a year to conceptualize and design this program because we wanted to make sure that it is responsive to the needs of the sector. It is trying to plug some of the big challenges that we see right now around us. And in order to plug that chicken and egg story or address that chicken and egg story, what we have done in the program is we have raised philanthropic capital to the tune of $3 million.
Okay.
We are using that capital to, one, provide capital assistance to these companies so that they can expand and scale up their business and move from those tens and hundreds of deployments into thousands and tens of thousands of deployments. So there is a capital support being provided. And it is being provided in the form of grant, but it is milestone linked trust grants, which are making sure that the businesses are growing and the commercial deployments are growing as the companies evolve. But alongside, we are also providing technical assistance to these companies so that their overall business grows and the companies get mature in order to absorb commercial capital in the form of equity and debt as they grow forward. But while we support the companies at one end, that was not the overall objective of the program, especially for CEW, which is a systems transformer, so to say, if I may use that word. Our interest is not just to grow a few companies. Our interest is to see the sector as a whole evolving. So the theory of change of the program is on back of these company success, we're generating evidence on the ground that whether these solutions work, whether they are able to improve the income of the end user, whether end user is able to pay back for these solutions if they've taken a loan or a credit, and whether the operations of these enterprises themselves are investable and scalable. And we use and leverage all that evidence with policymakers, with financiers, with investors, so that we can unlock the support, not just for these enterprises, but for the sector as a whole, so that we can overall raise the confidence profile of the sector. And after the companies that we are supporting in the program, which are about 15 odd companies, the 16th company should not face the same lack of confidence from these stakeholders as they enter the market.
Fair. That's really a wonderful program concept. And rather than saying just a concept, it's really taken off, as you rightly said, well-intended, well-structured. And it's a win-win value proposition for both CEW and WillGrow in this initiative. And rightly, like you said, you just don't want to stop with a few enterprises succeeding and just coming out of the program with success, but you need to create an ecosystem that helps other enterprises come up and sustain in the long run. Now, it's been like more than a year into the program, and in between all this, we had like unprecedented times. So how did this transition and how has this journey been during this period for the program?
Yeah, I mean, as you rightly said, I think just as we launched our cohort, in fact, a couple of months even before we launched our cohort, COVID hit all of us. So, as you would remember, that the first wave was the most uncertain. I mean, no one knew what needed to happen. We saw major disruptions in the world around us with regards to lockdown, economy. I mean, major parts of the economy almost coming to standstill. And it is in those times we started with the program. So, of course, very unprecedented, challenging times. But we were sure and certain that the problem that we are trying to solve is not going to go away because of the pandemic. It is going to be there, and we need to make sure that we are doubling down, in fact, our efforts. So we did provide some of the emergency funding support to the cohort that we had recently selected back then.
Nice.
And these were six enterprises. Both from the agriculture value chain as well as textile value chain, because we knew that these young, small micro enterprises, I mean, not micro, but young, small enterprises are themselves struggling to make and meet in that situation where cash flows were almost coming to a stagnant.
True.
Their pending payments from some of the sales that they had made were not coming through. So almost 1 crore worth of emergency funding we provided to these companies just to tide over that immediate crisis that we were all staring at. But we also used that time to make sure that these companies become more resilient. And a lot of interesting things also happened alongside. So for example, some of the companies actually used the, so to say, the challenging environment around us and created opportunities out of it.
Wonderful.
One of the company, Greenware, who is part of our portfolio, which is working in the solar-based textiles and solar-based garment value chain, actually leveraged that opportunity and started creating cotton-based masks by employing women who were using solar-powered sewing machines to sew these masks. And the fabric for these masks was coming from solar-powered looms.
Wonderful.
And they ended up employing many such women who otherwise, whose households were struggling because the men of these households had gone back from the urban areas and were not able to find livelihood opportunities. So some of these women became basically the primary earner in those times for these households.
That's wonderful. I mean, it's really good to know about the impact that it's had. I read a few articles that said about the amount of impact that it's had on women empowerment. I think that's also a primary focus for the program, right?
Yeah. And I mean, when I say that what we are trying to do both with the enterprises and the sector Gender inclusion is something which is a through and through focus for the program, and quite explicitly so. So it's not just something that we are trying to do implicitly, but we have actual cash on the table for enterprises to further gender inclusion in their business models, to make sure that they are able to sensitively target more and more women end beneficiaries and end customers while they are deploying these solutions in the rural areas. And to make sure that they understand that this is not something a social good to do activity, but it makes actually complete business sense for them to do so. When you think about rural livelihoods, predominantly women play a very significant role in rural livelihoods in India, both be it farm or be it non-farm activities. In the textile value chain, I mean, there is a huge number of women that are employed in tens of millions across the country. Be it the dairy and animal husbandry value chain, where most of the cattle management is done by women. So yeah, so women are actually the end customers for many of these products, even though the asset may not be in their names, due to the prevailing patriarchal system that we all are familiar with. But it is essentially important to hear what your customer is facing as challenges and responding to those needs through their business solutions. And slowly our companies, despite trying to make their end meet in these strange times that we are in, have realized the value of why focusing on women is important and are undertaking right now several initiatives to plug those gaps.
That's really great to know about this. Now, the original intent was the program had like a timeline of up to 2023. Is it the same, or because we are still going through a lot of waves in between? So what's the status like? Do you see any extension, or what are the next steps in the program?
Yeah, so you're correct. I mean, the program right now is planned. I mean, this current phase of the program is planned until March 2023. And we are still sticking to that timeline, which means that there is more and more hard work required, which is also happening in the preceding year or so with the companies and with the sector. And we are also sticking to the same targets that we have for the program. We have an aim to enable at least 10,000 livelihoods on back of the program efforts in the rural areas through these micro enterprises and so on. We are also aiming for at least 4x growth in the revenue of these enterprises whom we are supporting at a cumulative level. And we are looking to unlock many more commercial transactions in the sector, both in terms of debt and equity. Now that we are about almost halfway into the program's journey, despite the COVID challenges, I'm glad that we are almost hitting the 50% targets in terms of our outcomes. So we already have enabled 5,000 livelihoods across the country on back of the program enterprises in the last year and a half. And also almost 83% of these 5,000 livelihoods that have been enabled are with women. So you can see the amount of focus that the program has on women and beneficiaries. And alongside, the companies themselves have grown, and we have seen a cumulative revenue increase of almost 2x in the last year and a half among the enterprises. And it's great to see that, because despite the challenging times where many small enterprises had to shut shop, unfortunately, these program enterprises have stayed not just resilient, but they are also growing pretty effectively in these times. But that's just on the program, so to say, the enterprises side. But as I said, a very core focus of the program is also on moving the sector forward.
Fair.
So one of the things that we do in the program is very closely engaged with financiers and investors. So people who are investing into these enterprises, but also who are probably providing financing to the end users. So end user financiers like your small finance banks, your some of the NBFCs or regional rural banks and so on. So we have 16 such financiers and investors on board who meet every quarter. And we convene them for two primary purposes. One, to know from them, like, what is the data that they want to see? What is the evidence that they want to see so that they can start unlocking the support? So that the data that the program is gathering is actually already responsive to the needs of the stakeholders who are going to act on that data and evidence. And the second thing that we try to do is help these financiers and investors understand the challenges, the operational challenges and nitty-gritties that the companies go through. So that when they are thinking about investing into these companies and they are thinking about creating loan products for these solutions, they are already familiar with what the realities of the space are and are able to then respond to those realities. And again, I mean, on back of the program efforts, on back of some of these engagements, we've already unlocked 4 such commercial deals, including debt and equity for the program enterprises.
Wonderful.
And one yet final thing that we have done on the sectoral front is also engaging very closely with the Ministry of New and Renewable Energy and make sure that they are able to understand how this sector is evolving, which can have a very unique potential. A great potential to impart large-scale jobs and livelihoods in the rural area. And on back of the program team's effort, we have seen now a draft policy from the Government of India, which focuses particularly on how to leverage decentralized renewable energy to enhance livelihoods and incomes. And it is first such policy anywhere in the world which focuses on the use of decentralized renewables for livelihood. I mean, we have already seen Government of India making a large commitment to solar pumps, for example, which are again a livelihood-enabled solution for irrigation and agriculture. But here we are talking about now many more solutions that would be focused and supported as part of this. Hopefully, the upcoming policy, I mean, the final policy also should be coming out reasonably soon.
Wonderful. In terms of impact, I don't think the program could have achieved any more because it's really phenomenal numbers considering the times we have been. And like you mentioned, resilience has been a key part in the program's transformation of the enterprises as well. And that's really great to know in terms of impact, in terms of revenue growth, and also access to capital and finance. Even if during these times, if NBFCs and others are interested to provide end user capital, those are really good signs that the program has been a phenomenal success. And like you said, in the end, towards the end, draft policy on energy access and livelihoods is something that's not been out anywhere in the world. So that brings me to my final point, Abhishek. CEW as a think tank who has this aspiration to kind of enable policy transformation and have a great impact. I mean, there are a lot of learnings that you have picked up in this program and you have collaborated with philanthropic money and other agencies and being a global think tank with access to global network. So where do you see this program being adopted in the future? Do you see any global collaborations in other geographies? Where do you think such kind of programs can be implemented going forward?
Thanks, Girish. I think that's an excellent point that you raised there. And let me respond to it in a couple of ways. I think if you look at generally the global space and the innovation that is happening in the energy access space globally, increasingly, everyone is talking about that the next frontier is for the energy access is to focus on productive use and livelihood, because everyone sees that that's the area where a lot of economic opportunity can be unlocked, and the energy access projects themselves can be made a lot more sustainable. But if you look at from conversation to action, you would see India is one of the leading country where a lot of action is also happening when it comes to productive use. Of course, powering livelihood is driving a lot of it, but there are quite a few other organizations, including Selco Foundation and several others, who have been doing a lot of work on furthering energy access for rural livelihoods. And I think in many ways, India has become this testbed of innovation, not just the technological innovations, but also the market innovations, the business model innovations, the policy innovations.
Correct.
And there is a lot that India can offer to the developing South at large in terms of how to go about scaling the local markets, how to go about catalyzing those initial enterprises and initial innovation in the respective markets. And some of the program partners whom we work with already have those kinds of interests. Like some of the donors are also funding initiatives in sub-Saharan Africa. And we do believe very strongly that the program can offer a lot of learnings that can be useful not just for the civil society, but also for the policymakers, also for the financiers and investors in these geographies to take forward those aspirations around productive use and make them a reality.
Wonderful. That's really great to know. And as you rightly said, since the donor agencies are global in nature, they definitely would want to leverage this and create a bigger impact in the global South. So that's wonderful. Abhishek, firstly, it's been great to have worked with you and known you for a long time and seen this transformation from energy access to kind of powering livelihoods, and having this conversation with you, we kind of see that the impact that energy access can have as a whole is something that I've observed following your work for a long time. So it's really wonderful to have you on the podcast today and have this conversation to kind of enlighten listeners about the importance of having energy and kind of improving the livelihood. So thanks for taking time to join me on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Girish. I really enjoyed our conversation. And it's been, again, a pleasure knowing you for all these years. And I do hope that Mission Shunya keeps on growing and increasing its audience base. And I do hope this conversation would also find some resonance with our audience. Thanks a lot, Girish.
Well, at the end of this conversation, you'll appreciate the fact that we all can talk at length about the need for climate action and the intent to go big on scale and speed. But we do have to accept the fact that a large set of population, the global population, who will probably have no access to this conversation, also don't have access to basic amenities like electricity, which is very crucial for decent livelihood. A project like what Abhishek spoke about is essential on ground to ensure that there is equity in this journey of climate action. Between the time of the recording of the interview and the release of this episode, the Indian government, the Ministry for New and Renewable Energy, has released the official document on promoting decentralized renewable energy for livelihood applications, which is what Abhishek mentioned during the conversation. The document provides solutions, ideas on how to scale currently available distributed renewable energy sources and how to develop new applications based on that. Post the release, I also had a brief exchange with Abhishek, and he feels the market size for these type of applications that the document mentions is about upwards of $50 billion. So yes, there is in fact plenty of potential at the bottom of the pyramid. Hope this conversation was useful to you. Let me know your feedback. missionshunya@gmail.com is the ID as usual. You can reach out to Abhishek on LinkedIn or Twitter. The links to connect with Abhishek will be in the show notes section as usual. And finally, you would have noticed the special change in graphics of late. So that's thanks to our design partner TerraGeneration.com, a content and marketing agency specialized in telling the stories of people and organizations working in climate action, biodiversity conservation, and sustainability. So with that, it is a wrap on this episode. I will be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, this is Girish Shivakumar signing off. And as always, thank you for listening.